Welcome to the Great Pace Podcast, episode 86. I'm Steve Smith, along with Brandon Flanagan. We're in Boynton Beach, Florida. We're at the FM Tennis Performance Center.
Don't forget the tennis part, the most important part.
And it says on the pen, play, perform, recover. Really excited tonight. Part one, we're going to talk to Roger Crawford. Roger Crawford, the Roger. Amazing, amazing story. I first met Roger in the 80s. I read an article in Tennis Magazine. He was called Mr. Motivation, and he's disabled in all four limbs, played Division I college tennis, wrote a letter to him, and next thing you know, he was visiting our campus, and he came back a second time. I know some of our students from days gone by love to listen to Roger. You need to find out about his website, his books, great motivational speaker. I mean, he's walking example of mental toughness. One of our students, Craig Tiley, he's now the CEO of Tennis Australia. Roger got to meet Roger. Tiley had Roger Crawford down as a guest for the Australian Open. They have a conference, and so he got a chance to meet Roger. But Sports Illustrated said that Roger Crawford, I have it in my notes here, we had everything from his high school record to his college record. One of the most accomplished athletes, physically challenged, accomplished athletes in the history of sport. But let me give him a call. This will be great. We're looking good.
Hi, Steve.
Roger Crawford. Great to have you on as a guest. We just told
her. Well, thank you, Steve. It's great to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I mean, Brandon Flanagan, he certainly has heard your story, and so many of our students from the 80s, but I think that everybody in tennis benefits so much by hearing from your stories. But I know you're busy, and I know I didn't tell you that some of these podcasts are so long because we start with the individuals telling us about their beginning days in tennis and sport. But let's do that with yourself. Tell us your story from day one, how you get going in sports.
Yeah, well, Steve and Brandon, I'll tell you, it's fun to talk about my favorite subject, which is tennis, because tennis really changed my life. I was born with a physical challenge. It affects all four of my limbs, from the elbows down and from the knees down. So for people listening, I have one finger on my right hand, two fingers on my left. I have three toes on my right foot and a partially developed lower right leg. And my left leg was amputated when I was 5 years old. So today I wear an artificial leg or prosthesis. So that doesn't sound like someone who was built for the game of tennis, but I was very fortunate growing up that I had a mother and father that shared with me that everybody is challenged in some way. You know, some challenges you can see and some you can't. It just so happened that mine was visible. So I didn't grow up with the idea that somehow I was disadvantaged. I just had to do things a little differently than everyone else. So I've always been a huge sports fan. And I found that if I could be on the basketball court, the football field, or the tennis court, and I could compete with able-bodied people, then in my own eyes, that I felt equal. And I didn't feel disabled. I felt that I had just different abilities. So that's how I found the game of tennis. And it was when I was 12 years old, Steve, and I walked into a tennis store. And on the wall, I saw what I believe is the holy grail of tennis rackets. I'm still convinced this racket was made just for me. And it was the Wilson T2000.
Jimmy Connors.
So we got a lot of tennis fans. You remember that racket, Steve?
Yeah, sure.
Sure. And for people listening that are not familiar with the Wilson T2000, the best way that I could describe it is that from the head of the racket to the grip, there were two parallel bars, and it was open from the bottom of the head of the racket until the top of the grip. Well, when I picked the racket up, something very interesting happened. My right finger, keep in mind, I have one finger on my right hand, got stuck in between the two parallel bars. And then I found a solution with how was I going to hold on to the tennis racket. and I would hold the grip to my right elbow with my left hand. So I would hit everything with two hands. And having that racket secure on my right hand just opened up a world of possibilities for me in tennis. So I started playing tennis against a backboard and just worked as hard as I could, and then finally was able to get up to the level where I was able to rally with other people. And like I said, it really changed my life. It really did. It changed how I saw myself. It changed what I believed was possible.
Oh, that's great. With your parents, if there was a Hall of Fame, I know you're in quite a few Hall of Fames. If there was a Hall of Fame for parents, from you know what I've read and listening to you, that your parents would be in. You didn't actually walk until you're five, is that right?
Yeah, until I was five, Steve, because the left leg that I was born with, as I mentioned to you, was underdeveloped. And my parents made a very difficult decision, but it really turned out to be the best one. And that was to amputate the bottom part of my left leg so that I could wear an artificial leg or prosthesis. I'm sure that was a very tough decision for them. And being a parent myself, I can only imagine the thought process that went in that. But it was so incredible for me to have that ability to walk and that ability to run. So they made a great decision. You know, for people that are listening to this, I would say that one of the best lessons that my mother and father gave me was this. You don't live in Pity City. The point was this. Don't spend a lot of time feeling sorry for yourself. Don't spend a lot of time making excuses. Because I really believe that the quickest way that we can increase results in our life is by decreasing excuses. Because we all know that we can find something in our life that's wrong, that's negative. We can find other people or circumstances to blame. That's when we take that responsibility for becoming the best version of ourselves. I think that's really what success is.
Absolutely. Yeah.
With what else comes to your mind with your parents? There's just so many stories that you could share.
You know, Steve, I think more than anything, it was that not allowing me to fall into a state of despair because of my circumstances. In addition, not allowing me to use that as an excuse for not being my best. And trust me, I became very skilled at using my hands and my legs as an excuse. And my mom and dad would shut that down quickly.
I love your story about Velcro, where it took you X amount of years to learn to tie a pair of shoes, right? And then somebody invented Velcro.
Yeah. I mean, tying my shoes was like my last step to independence. And I remember it was so important to me to learn how to tie my shoes. I'd no longer have to ask someone to help. And after 16 years, you know, they invent Velcro shoes. And I kept thinking, you know, where was that when I was growing up? But it was a good lesson for me. And it was that that perseverance is a combination of purpose and persistence. And also patience. See, sometimes we forget that part. You know, we think, well, I'm going to be persistent. But a big part of being persistent is being patient.
Mm. Roger, I know you're a commercial for hitting the backboard. You became, as your coach Tony Fisher called you, Mr. Backboard. But you played other sports before you got hooked on tennis, correct?
I did. I played basketball, and I also played football. In fact, I want to tell you a funny story about that. Because so I was playing football. I was a defensive end, and during one particular game, the quarterback on the other team went back to pass, and the play started to develop, and my teammate rushed in and tackled the quarterback before I could get there, and I thought that the play had ended, but I was mistaken. The quarterback fumbled the football, and as luck would have it, I picked it up, and I started running, and I'll never forget, I was running down the sidelines, and I could see the end zone was in sight. You know, I was so close to scoring a touchdown, you know, one of the dreams of my life. And about the 5-yard line, a young man on the other team attempted to tackle me and he grabbed a hold of my left leg. Well, I was very fortunate that day because he selected my left leg and it came right off. But that didn't stop me. That didn't stop me because I was still standing and I hopped into the end zone. And I wish you could have been there because there was dead silence in the stadium. People could not believe what they had seen. I remember the opposing coach, he runs over the ref. He says, "Hey, ref, what's the ruling on that?" So ref, he's looking through the rule book. He said, "He came apart right in front of me." He said, "But his knee didn't touch the ground. I got to give him a touchdown." So, yeah, that story is, I love that story for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's a great memory. But number two, a number of years ago, I was speaking to a group. There was a gentleman in the audience who was also going to be speaking on the program. And I was so, I felt so honored that he would take the time to come in and listen to my program. And after I was finished, he walked up to me and he said, "Roger, I love that football story." He said, "I'm writing a new book. And if you give me permission, I'd like to use that football story." And I said, "Gosh, you know, I really appreciate, you know, you wanting to include me." He said, "I can't compensate you in any way." I said, "Oh, no, that's no problem. I just would love to be a part of your book." And so he hands me this release form and I'm filling it out. And I said to him, "Who's your publisher?" And he looked at me and he said, "Well, Roger, at this point, we don't have a publisher." He said, "But I want you to know this book is going to be number one on the New York Times bestseller list September 1st of next year." And I can remember thinking, how in the world is this going to be number one on the New York Times bestseller list when at this point in the process, they don't have a publisher? And then he told me the title, Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Oh, wow.
It was the very first book in the Chicken Soup series. And that football story that I just shared with you was in that book. So yeah. I felt really thrilled to have been a part of that project. And, you know, my story was one of many, but I was thrilled to be in the first Chicken Soup for the Soul book. So I love that story for a variety of reasons.
No, that's great. With looking up information on yourself, you're born in 1960. I think we met maybe in 1984, 85.
Right.
You moved really well. I know you played a lot of driveway basketball, but you started at a very, very early age with a prosthesis, correct? I mean, you were a natural.
I did when I was five. You know, Stephen, and I would watch players on the tennis court, and I watched how they moved. And even though I had an artificial leg, I tried to emulate them. So I didn't put in my mind that because you have an artificial leg, you can't do something. Now, granted, did I have to adapt? Sure, but I'd watch how they moved. And yeah, I mean, I could move fairly well on the tennis court. Now today, with the new technology, it's truly amazing what people are able to do, amputees. It's remarkable.
No, I remember. Also, your forehand, the way you held that, you know, it's amazing how many two-handed players have short, compact swings. Like players are two hands on both sides. But my background with Vic Braden, you certainly had a very efficient forehand. More calculation where you hit more slice on the backhand side. But that, but the way the brain works, we know now through Daniel Coyle's book, or better yet, Anders Ericsson, the late Dr. Erik Anderson, the 10,000 hour rule. You were a machine as far as just all those reps on the backboard.
Right. Well, what I realized was that my best strategy to be successful on the tennis court was to hit the ball over the net one more time than the other person. I wasn't going to be the fastest or the most powerful, but I could be consistent. And this is a message that I carry with me today. Clients I work with, audiences I speak to, is the importance of consistency. It's more valuable than perfection. Because very rarely, if ever, can we reach the level of perfection, but we can always be consistent. And let's think about that for a moment in all areas of our lives, how vitally important consistency is. you know, circumstances are going to change, but we can still be consistent.
No, your coach, in your youth, said you were 4 hours or 4 to 5 hours a day on the backboard. I mean, we have a lot of listeners, the tennis parents that are driving their children to tournaments or practice. That's such a great lesson, is to put the hours in and to be.
Well, there's no substitute for that. There's no substitute for the hours. And also it's finding your giftedness on the tennis court and make that gift that you have the best it can be. The best it can be. And, you know, I always say to people, you know, no matter how hard I practice, I've come to the realization that I'm never going to be the best Roger in tennis. But I can be the best Roger Crawford I can. And that's true for everybody.
Yeah. Tell us about meeting Roger. I mentioned that during the intro that Craig Tiley, who you met at Tyler Junior College when you first came out to visit, he had you down as a guest, the CEO of Tennis Australia. What was it like to meet Roger versus Roger?
There's a lot of people that talk about how gracious and authentic Roger Federer is. And I will tell you, I experienced that as well. He was one of the most genuine, caring human beings I've really ever met. And here's why I say that. I think about him, his wife, how busy he is, how many people he meets, the demands on his time. But yet, he was very present during the conversation. And really, you felt like he cared, he was interested. And you know, many people besides myself have said that. But I just found him to be an incredibly impressive human being. And I think he would be an impressive human being if he wasn't such a great champion. Mm-hmm. I just think his heart is one that genuinely cares about people. I think he wants to make a difference. And I think he is filled with gratitude. I mean, this is my impression. I can't say that I know him, but from the time that I interacted with him. And over the years, I've met people that have interacted with Roger, and they say similar things. I would also say that's true about Rafa Nadal as well. I've been around him a bit, and I found him to have that same mindset.
I'd love to have you tell us a story about Rafa, but before you do that, what Rafa told you about practice, his next goal. But I think, like yourself, Roger Federer, I mean, I've read so much about his parents. You know, with Federer, it was his parents' idea when he was acting up at a tennis academy, the National Swiss program, to make him get up every morning and clean toilets. Roger, there's so many stories where he made fun of a girl who could not speak Swiss German, a Turkish girl, and Lynette Federer made him apologize both in writing and orally. But yeah, I think that parents shine through when you see someone with that much class.
Yeah, no, he's class that to me is a word to describe Roger Federer. And I would also say this about him, that he is someone who is really striving to give back to the game. I think he understands his status in the game and how great he's been. But you ever notice how he honors the former greats? I mean, they're always greats, but that were great at one period in time and gotten a bit older, and how he always honors them. I think he really embraces the legacy of tennis, the history of tennis. And he knows what tennis has done for him. And I think he wants to help others have a similar experience. That's kind of my take on it.
You know, I think along with, you know, as the agent, Tony Gossick, I know that Tiley is involved in that with Tennis Australia, the development of the Laver Cup, where, you know, to honor Rod Laver and the players from the past. No, for sure. I think that to really understand the subject, I mean, it's been said that you have to know the history of the subject. And I think that's something that's in tennis, it's not held in a high enough regard as to have great respect for the players from the past. I know that so many juniors will watch and they look at a YouTube clip and the players are playing with wooden rackets and they go, gee, the ball, they're hitting the ball so slowly. And it's true. Mm-hmm. You measure the speed, the time in between shots, but still the skill level was amazing for players in the past.
Oh, tremendous. And the camaraderie that some of the former players had, I think it still exists somewhat in the sport of tennis. I don't know. It's not the same as it was in earlier years. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But no, I can't think of a greater sport to be involved with than tennis. And the reason I say that is there's so many life lessons that you can take from the game of tennis and apply it in your personal life, in your professional life. I think it gives you the opportunity of being exposed to a lot of different circumstances to teach you to be adaptable, teach you to be innovative, how to respond to change. And I just think those are such valuable lessons. Can you learn them in the other sports? Yes, but I'm not sure it's as accessible as it is in tennis, part of it being an individual sport, but it's also the nature of the sport.
Yeah, you're spot on with the challenge. Braden used to always say, a ball comes out of a machine at 30 miles an hour, you change the racket face by 1 degree, the ball goes 6 feet further. So it's such a difficult sport. One thing with that, today, it's changed so much in this country, where the better junior players, unfortunately, almost straight across the board, they're not playing high school tennis. But let's talk a little about team tennis. But before you do that, just touch upon that story with Rafa where you asked him what his goal was.
Right. Well, I had a really wonderful opportunity. For a couple of years, I was able to do a small segment on Tennis Channel called Motivational Mondays with Roger Crawford. And so grateful for that experience. And because of it, I got to go to some of the major tournaments and interact with a few of the players. And I remember being in a room where Rafa Nadal was doing a press conference. And question was, they asked him, was what goal would you like to accomplish? You know, what goal would you like to achieve in the future? And I'm thinking that he's going to say, maybe, you know, I'm going to win the French another time. Or, you know, this year I want to win Wimbledon. He said something that I've never forgotten. He said, have a good practice tomorrow.
Amazing.
And when they followed up, he said, that's all I'm focused on. Because if I can have a good practice tomorrow, and I can take that success into the next day. And I thought, wow, what an incredible mindset to have. And think of, you take that mindset into other areas of your life. I mean, how many of us, right? We get so caught up into the what if in the future. You know, what if this happens? What if that happens? But what if we just concentrate on good practice tomorrow? Yeah. Wow.
Scotty Perelman.
And think of the cumulative effect.
Scotty Perelman was a guest. He was on the staff when I worked at Vic Braden's, and now he's one of the coaches at the University of Florida. And he was on after his team won the national championship, and he's a dynamo. He walks around and he sees people. First thing, instead of saying good morning, he goes, it's a new day, new opportunity to excel. And it's true. You got to make the best of each day. I tell people every day is a tournament day. You know, you don't want to be looking at the tournament day as a different day. Every day is the same. You got to make the best of it.
Absolutely. And what it does also, doesn't it? It gives us great perspective. You know, that was one thing. I know how much you, you know, had an amazing relationship and what a tremendous influence Vic Braden has been on your life. And I really didn't know Vic Braden, but he had really a huge impact on me. And one was the idea of having fun and laughter.
Yeah, his motto and is laugh and win. That's a great message. I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, his motto is laugh and win. Go ahead, Roger.
No. That was great. Yeah, laugh and win, right. I mean, didn't you notice that, Steve? I mean, when you were working with him, that he had a sense of joy about himself. And again, I really can't say that I knew him. But he had a sense of joy that I found very contagious. And I think that sense of joy, when you bring it to the game of tennis, it can only contribute to your success.
Yeah, I think it was Jefferson who said the two things you need to have is integrity and humor. So it's, you know, and he was, as you know, so funny. I think a good lesson for all comedians is to make fun of yourself first.
Absolutely.
Tell us about high school tennis. I mean, you're doing some homework. You're 46 and 7, but I think that's one thing that tennis kids today in the U.S., they're losing out because they're not playing high school tennis.
Right. Well, when I was growing up, everybody played high school tennis.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
You know, even the top-ranked players played high school tennis. I think that the opportunity to play high school tennis for some of the top juniors, their initial thinking may be, well, I'm not going to have the competition that I need or whatever. I think they might be overlooking something that's just as important, and that is the camaraderie of being a teammate, the ability to, you know, hang out with, you know, the other players, get to know them, get to know their lives, travel with them. And that's an incredibly valuable experience. And I'm sad that there are some young people that are passing that up. And I'm assuming that, I mean, everybody has their reason, but I'm assuming one of the reasons is feeling that they need to have, you know, a certain level of competition. Again, high school tennis for me was just an incredible, incredible experience. And I just loved being part of the team. I loved competing. And I'm sure that when people are listening, they're thinking, okay, well, this guy, he's got three fingers, one leg, half a foot, you know, he must have been at a real disadvantage. Well, let's think about this for a moment. When somebody walked down the tennis court and they realized that they were playing me, the pressure was on. Because how many people want to say, yeah, I just got beat by somebody who's got three fingers and one leg? Nobody wants to say that. So that was a bit of an advantage in many, many ways. The other part of it was, and I really felt this way, I thought being out there and competed, I already won.
Yeah.
I already won. Just being out there was a big win. Now, did I want to be victorious? Of course. Did I take it serious? Absolutely. But, you know, there was just a sense of accomplishment being out there.
I do think the line for high school tennis is, unfortunately, the individuals become bigger than the program. But even before high school tennis, what's going on now in the U.S., is there's no residency rules. It used to be if you're from this village, this township, that's where you play. And you'd play in a house league. And then if you were successful enough, you'd play on a travel and all-star team. And that all-star team would have a limited schedule. You'd just play, say, a Sunday house league was on a Saturday. So actually, I think sports has become too organized. And I do think the scenario of saying, well, there's a dad who's, you know, recruiting, and he's found an 8-year-old who's as big as a 12-year-old, or a 12-year-old who's, you know, maybe it's a 12-year-old team, and it's a kid who's already shaving, you know, because there's such a differentiation from one kid to the next when their kids are 13, 14 years old. But, and they're looking for that 2-inch trophy, but then they end up spending all this time driving around town instead of playing sports in their backyard. So the sandlot sports, the pickup sports have gone away. So I think in that sense, it's too structured. I think it's really sad that, you know, kids are playing in the, you know, they're elementary age kids, and every time they play a match, it becomes computerized. They have a digital record on what a kid's, you know, how they're doing in the fourth grade. I think that's unfortunate. So that
right.
Word play is, and I know that you're big on, you know, it's a scoreboard of life. It's not really the scoreboard. Are you just competing?
Well, absolutely. And I also believe that the real competitor that you have is yourself. That's really who you're competing about. Let me explain that. It's about, can you defeat self-doubt? Can you defeat discouragement? Can you defeat fear? That's the real opponent. And the measure of success, I believe, is, did you get a little bit better? Did you improve? I think that's the metric. You know, I think it's much bigger than win or loss. I know for me, some of the most successful matches I ever competed in, I lost. But there was something I learned from that match. I had some growth. I gained some wisdom. So that's a big win. So I don't think it's just about wins and losses. Are they important? Absolutely. But I think it's bigger than that. And I think there's more to be gained than that. So it's like I would say to people, nobody hit a winner sitting on the bench. So just being out there is a positive, and you got to put that in the win column. And then elevating yourself, becoming better, improving.
Go ahead, Randy.
Absolutely, yes. Self-improvement. I've it's incredible listening to you talk, and your story is the definition of inspiration.
Thank you.
I wanted to share this with you on a personal note. Running summer tennis camps in South Florida for the last 13 years. There's not one summer that's gone by we haven't shown your YouTube video. There's many of them, but there's one that we would show every year. And it was a tremendous inspiration for all the tennis players in our summer camp. So I want to thank you for that on a personal note.
Thank you.
So, and you know, Steve shared your story with me many years ago. And so it's just been great to continue to share your story to other young tennis players.
Well, thank you. Steve's been a real inspiration to me over the years, and having been part of his program at Tennis Tech, really had a huge impact on me. And to see what Steve's done and how he's grown the game and had impact and has made a difference in a lot of people's lives, I find that very inspiring. So thank you for that. I appreciate that very, very much.
I appreciate the kind words. Your adversity quotient is right up there. I know you, as a professional speaker, you've talked to so many special interest groups. Do you still spend quite a bit of time talking to tennis groups? I mean, you think you're the walking model for mental toughness. We spent so much time with Dr. Jim Lehrer. He was part of the Tennis Tech program, and he's one of our pillars. But that should happen more. Tell us a little bit of your connection with tennis today. I mean, you do much with tennis groups? I know you had the Tennis Channel.
Well, Steve, every so often I'll be asked to speak to a tennis group, but I don't do it as much as I would like. I spend a good deal of my time speaking to corporate groups and association groups. I want to stay connected as much as I can to tennis. I still play tennis at 61 years of age. I'm still out there playing and enjoying it. The connection to tennis for me is, I find it so gratifying. I love to be around tennis people. I think tennis people have this, I think they have a very refreshing attitude, refreshing perspective. They like health and wellness, and they like, you know, being their best. And those are the kind of people I like to be around. So, you know, I'd certainly like to keep that connection as much as possible. Probably, Wilson Sporting Goods has been very, very good to me over the years, and they provided me with equipment and clothes. And, you know, I've spoken to their organization a number of times, and I just hold that organization in high esteem. I think they're terrific. I'm hoping to do more speaking, you know, to tennis groups. I'm hoping that's going to be in my future.
Go ahead, Brandon.
Yeah, I would love it if you could kind of take us through your high school years on the high school tennis team with such a great record, and then carry that into your time at Loyola Marymount.
Sure. Well, you know, the tennis team that I played on, it was Northern California. It was a pretty good level of high school tennis. You know, we did really well as a team and enjoyed being part of it. I think what I enjoyed most was I enjoyed being around and hanging with my teammates. Many of them are still my very, very good friends. I love the competition. It also was, again, an affirmation that I could compete against able-bodied players. I'm often asked this, Roger, you know, did you ever think about participating in the Paralympics? And I always laugh. I said, when I was growing up, there was no such thing as the Paralympics. Mm. It didn't exist. I always wanted to view myself as an athlete that had a physical challenge, not a physically challenged athlete. I think the Paralympics are awesome, and I admire people that compete in those games and those competitions. But for me, it was just important that I had the mindset that, look, I wasn't going to lead with having a physical challenge. I was an athlete, and I'm going to focus on that, not having a physical challenge. So I think that served me pretty well. In high school, I just kind of stayed in my lane. I just kept that ball coming back. Gave myself plenty of net clearance, gave myself a lot of margin, kept the ball deep in the court, and I just kept it coming back. I remember one of my favorite players was a guy named Harold Solomon.
Oh, yeah.
And Harold Solomon used to have this shot. He called it the moon ball. And boy, I loved hitting the moon ball. When somebody would pull me out of court, and I knew I had to get back in the point, give myself that extra time, I just fire up that moon ball. And I love that shot. I've never met Harold Solomon, but if I ever did, I'd say, you know, thank you for teaching me how to hit the moon ball.
Harold Solomon, you know, he's got to be no more than 5'7". I tease people and say I work for Harold Solomon because one summer I was working for brain cramp, it'll come to me. Someone who played in the same conference, Solomon played at Rice. Sace Mahauer's brother, can't come up with a name here. Maharaj, I should just get it. Senior citizen. So anyway, with Solomon, I went to practice. It was a tournament in Stowe, Vermont, and I hit with his wife, Jan. And it was amazing. So it would be Harold, another pro, myself, and Jan. So I was Jan's sparring partner. He'd get two courts. And it was amazing because when he showed up, we all had dinner with him, and he had just lost to Borg, like 6-1, 6-1, 6-0. And he said when he played Borg, he just tried to get games. But, he was a grinder. He was a guy. And, I mean, he was in the semis of the French Open. Maybe, I don't think he went further than that, but he's a top 10 player in the world. Solomon. But no, that Harold, Bud Collins gave the shot, the high arcing ground stroke. I mean, people don't realize that Agassi did the same thing, but Agassi just hit one of them and then he would step in and really take the ball on the rise. But he would, you know, there for our juniors just to hear you to say that you got high net clearance. We're telling kids all the time you're hitting lasers, you know, that their kids are watching tennis on TV, the camera's shooting down, and they don't really have any idea how high the pros are hitting the ball over the net. We had some players today go down to Miami and watch the pro tournament, and a young player from Norway, Rude, one of the comments was how high he hits over the net, how deep he hits.
Right. Well, that's true. I hadn't really thought about that, but that's true. With the camera, the way they shoot a tennis match, you don't really see the clearance that they have over the net. In high school, I had pretty good success against people that, were not as consistent, were not as patient. But I did start to run into people that had a little higher skill that were able to, they had the power to really knock me off the court. And so I started realizing that, there was a certain level that I reached in tennis And then there was another level of player that had power, control, and angle. And, you know, that's where I realized that those players could beat me, but that didn't stop me from still focusing in on consistency.
Yeah, I have to apologize. Jeewon Maharaj. Actually, Brandon trained with us in Tampa, Florida 20 years ago. And when we started our program, Jeewon was grandfathered in, and I had worked for him. And he just worked on one clay court. You walk in, it was right to the left. And he was the one who played in the same conference with Solomon, but he hit the ball so well, Jeewon Maharaj. But a lot of times people, they don't really stop and watch the players, like you said, and really, really learn from them. I think now that, you know, kids don't even daydream so much because they go right to their cell phone. I think it's very good to daydream. Mm. But you must have had a lot of dreams hitting against the backboard.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I had a lot of dreams, and people always wonder, did anybody tell me, forget about it? It's impossible. You can't do it. Sure. A lot of people did. And people that are listening to this podcast, they've been told the same thing by other people. But here's my take. When someone says it's impossible, remember, that's an opinion. That's not a fact. And most often when someone says to you, you can't do it, what they're actually saying is, I can't do it. So they're projecting that on you. So, you know, what I would say to young people especially is, don't let another person tell you that you can't make your dreams come true.
You know, there was a
scene. That's their perspective. That doesn't have to be your perspective.
Mm-hmm. No, that's well put. There was a scene in the movie King Richard that we talked about where I really enjoyed the movie. I thought it was well done, but they didn't portray Braden very well because there was a scene.
Oh, really?
And it never really happened where Richard Williams met with Vic. But what was portrayed is that Vic told Richard that what he was trying to do was impossible, and Braden would have never done that.
No, I don't. I don't think I can't even imagine that.
Mm-hmm. No. So people who knew him, I mean, the glass it has to be half full, not half empty.
Mm-hmm.
So you go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, Steve.
I was going to say that, you know, Brandon asked about your transition to going to Southern Cal to play college tennis.
Right. Well, I decided that I really wanted to play Division I tennis. I realized that there was a level of program out there that I wasn't likely going to play a whole lot. But there were some programs that, you know, I had a shot at playing, and Loyola Marymount was one of them. And I always, when people ask me about playing college tennis and they say, how much has college tennis changed? Well, when I was playing college tennis, there wasn't a lot of players from overseas, which there is today, of course, which has, I think, elevated the level of competition without a doubt. But when I went to Loyola, I had a great coach, Jamie Sanchez, and I knew that he would give me a chance, that he would allow me to compete for a spot on the team. And, you know, he recruited me. He reached out to me. He heard about me and playing in the juniors and so forth. But he just was such an amazing coach. And did he want his team to win? Sure, of course. But just as importantly, he wanted his players to have an experience that would impact their life forever. And I can't think of another coach that I respect as much or more than Jamie Sanchez. Really was just such an amazing, and is, I mean, he and I are just very, very close friends. In fact, I saw him a couple months ago. But he's just an amazing person and who loves the game of tennis. who cherishes the opportunity to play tennis. And so he instilled that in his players. So we were a middle of the pack team in our conference, but nevertheless, just had a tremendous experience there.
No, it's so difficult to play college tennis. Less than 3% of kids play college tennis. And then there's really some overwhelming stats where if you don't make the lineup, 85% of players who don't make the lineup their freshman year don't make the lineup. So I think that many times juniors can look at college tennis through rose-colored glasses. That's where, you know, going back to you spending 4 or 5 hours on the backboard and, you know, getting one more ball back and the consistency,
right.
Consistency factor. There's so many pearls of wisdom that you're saying that juniors could go back and the parents of juniors and to make that transition from high school to college is not so easy.
Well, you're right, Steve. And I think for me, I feel very fortunate that I was playing in an era where the equipment that we had to play with, it wasn't as powerful of a game as it is now. But everything changes, right? Change is inevitable. So that also gave me an opportunity because, it was somewhat of a slower game. And so consistency is important no matter how powerful the strokes are, no doubt. But I think for me, it gave me that little extra time to set up and get into position.
With the Tennis Channel, our listeners, just go to YouTube. There's how many tennis tips did you do for the Tennis Channel? I was interrupted by the pandemic, right?
Probably 50 or so that's posted, probably 50 or so. Yeah, it was just an amazing experience. The people at Tennis Channel are just such terrific people. Ken Solomon is amazing. Mary Carrillo, Martina Navratilova, Jim Courier, Paul Anacone, all of them, Brett Haber, they've all been so good to me. And I learned a lot from them, I'll tell you.
Yeah, no,
they taught me a lot about broadcasting, and skill on the camera. But I just respect all of them. I'll tell you, Mary Carrillo is a very, she's an incredible person. And I have enjoyed the time that I've spent with her. I think she's an amazing announcer. She's a great person, very giving, loves the game of tennis. But everybody at Tennis Channel, I just can't say enough of them. And I'm so thankful that they gave me a shot.
Well, the listeners could go to YouTube and listen to those. Tell us about the books you've written.
Sure. So I wrote a book called How High Can You Bounce? And it's a book about resiliency. It's how do you bounce forward? It's not about bouncing back. I'm of the belief that if we go through adversity, we go through change and we come through it, we don't bounce back. It's actually forward. Mm-hmm. We move ahead. The reason for it is we have a different sense of self-awareness, maybe more self-confidence, a new understanding of our resiliency, our courage. So I think it's about bouncing forward. And the reason I wrote the book was to communicate to people that there are benefits to some adversity in life. There are benefits to that. It teaches us a lot of lessons. And for people listening, I want you to think back on maybe a disappointing loss that you had on the tennis court. And then I want you to think, what was the lesson? What did you take from it that'll help you move forward? So that kind of in a nutshell is how high could you bounce? And I wrote a book called Think Again. You know, there's that old saying, think again, think again. Well, I wanted people to think again about their self-doubts. Think again about what's possible, to reevaluate to re-engineer and then reach higher. So basically getting people to think about mindset, because I know we talked about this earlier, but I think mindset is the single best predictor of our success on the tennis court or off. Here's why. We rarely, if ever, perform better than we believe we can. Both of you teaching tennis, coaching tennis, you've seen this, and so has everybody listening has experienced this. If you believe that you're going to lose no matter what, you're going to work hard at proving yourself right. In the same respect, if you believe that you're going to win, you're going to be victorious, you're going to work really hard at proving yourself right. So that's why mindset is so, so important. And mindset is one of the controllables. A lot of circumstances, a lot of conditions on the tennis court and off that are completely uncontrollable. I mean, I think about my own life. I'm not going to change my hands or my legs. It is what it is. But our mindset determines how we see what is. That's why it's so powerful. You know, you look at the great tennis players, you look at a guy like, you know, Djokovic or Nadal or, you know, any of the greats, and you think, what separates them? How do they rise to the top? Well, I think the answer is complex. I think there's a lot of different factors. But I think the common denominator is belief. It's belief. Mm-hmm. And I talent takes us to a certain level. Okay, but I'm not sure that it's talent alone that takes us over the top. And what I mean by over the top, I think this is really important for people listening, is that in my opinion, and it's my opinion, but that success is becoming the best version of yourself, best version of you. There's not anyone in this world that has the same mindset or skill set that you have. So how can you take that mindset and skill set and become your very, very best at your chosen endeavor to fulfill your sense of purpose? That's what I think success is. Then I wrote a book called Playing from the Heart, which is my autobiography. Mm. And obviously the title is I Played from My Heart. That was it. That's what I draw from was my heart.
Mm. And tell us because about go ahead. I was going to say the website, but tell us how the listeners to go to your website and then tell us a little bit more about Playing from the Heart.
Yeah, they can go to my website, which is www.rogercrawford.com, or they can go to Amazon and order it that way. But yeah, Playing from the Heart is my story, and those are the books I've written, and I've got a few more in me, I think, at least a couple more. So like everyone, COVID has been something that I've had to navigate. It's changed my travel schedule. It changed some things, but it's not unlike everybody who's listening. I mean, it's been one of those changes that we couldn't anticipate, and it was an uncontrollable. Mm. So we have to adjust and adapt.
So obviously so many of your presentations in the past were in person. Do you do some remote work as well?
I do. I have a studio that I film my Zoom presentations, but I really do miss the in-person. Mm. There is a limitation to a computer screen. You can't get the same experience on a computer as you can in person. We're getting better. It's better, but it's not quite there yet.
Yeah, totally.
So I still think in person is, I think the in-person, it's coming back, but, it's not back yet, not 100% for sure.
Yeah.
And you're a grandfather. Tell us about that.
Well, being a grandpa is one of the greatest blessings of my life. I've got two little girls, and I've got a little grandson. And my grandkids are amazed that I have a college degree and I can't count on my fingers. It just blows their mind. They're in first and second grade and just can't believe that they call me Pop Daddy, that I can't count on my fingers. But, you know, it's been what an incredible experience to have these young people in your life and just love them so much and so excited for their future. And, you know, I just hope I can play a positive role for them. And, you know, they're going to grow up viewing people that have differences. They're going to have a little different perspective because they have a grandpa that looks like me. And I think that I hope that's going to serve them well. I think it has already. You know, I have one little granddaughter, Alex Jean. She said to me, she said, "You know, Pop Daddy," she says, "you got two fingers on one hand and you got one finger on the other, but I want you to know that's okay." And I thought, wow, what a great philosophy. That's okay. That's okay. So, no, it's been great. And I've got a great wife and life's good. You know, life's good. I cherish it every day. I think that through COVID especially, it's given us a new awareness of what's good and positive in our life, because it's given us a time to pause. So I think there's been some benefits in that. Give us time to reevaluate. So I think there's been some positives in that.
Our listeners are just tuning in for the first time and they've never heard you before. Obviously, they already know you're a great speaker. I love the story where you said when you were a kid, the positive attitude that the doorbell would ring and your dog would go crazy. And for 14 years, he'd run to the door, but your punchline was, it was never for him.
That's right. The dog never lost his optimism.
Yeah, enthusiastic.
Kept coming back, which is a great reminder to us, isn't it? That, you know, you can't win every race, but losing is guaranteed if you don't enter the race. If you don't try, if you don't make an attempt.
And also for our listeners, you became a USPTA certified pro, correct?
I did. Yeah, that was a number of years ago, but I really, really enjoy it. I think that's a great organization. I really do. And I loved being on the tennis court and teaching tennis. That was just incredibly gratifying to see people improve and improve their skill set and have the sense of enjoyment. I mean, it's such a great sport.
With why don't we wind this down? I know that we talked about doing it a second time. We would love to do that. Brandon, why don't you have a question?
Sure. Yeah, I want to thank you again and really appreciate you coming on
My pleasure.
I was hoping you could touch a little bit more on mindset. I know that you've touched thousands and thousands of lives over the years. I'm just curious if someone were to say to you that, well, mindset is something that I just can't change. What would be your response to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I'd ask them, can you change how you think? Mm. I mean, can you change the way that you think? I think for most people would say, sure. Well, if you can do that, then you can change your mindset. Understand it may not happen overnight. It might be gradual, but you can. Here's why. You control the quality and you control the content of your thoughts. And what I would ask somebody to do, and I don't know if you've read the book Mindset, but there was a study by Dr. Carol Dweck from Stanford University. She talks about growth mindset and fixed mindset. Now, someone who has a fixed mindset would be convinced that they can't change how they think. They can't change their mindset. And there's all these things in their life that are unchangeable. Then there's someone who has a growth mindset that believes that change is possible. Mm. So how do you flip it? How do you flip from fixed to growth? it's complex, first of all, because there's a lot of elements to it. But it begins with, I think, getting people to understand that the way that they're thinking, this is if they want to change it, the way that they're thinking is not serving them well. In other words, they start to see that their thinking, let's say their negative thinking, has held them back from realizing their potential. Mm. And then start to unpack that. Okay. Well, I didn't try this because I was convinced I was going to lose, or I was going to be disappointed, or I would fail. And then to start to unpack that a little bit and say, was that real or was that imagined? Mm. And then let's say you did fail. Well, that's not fatal. Right. So how can you take that and build momentum? So that would be the first thing, is to get people to understand that, and this is if they want to change. Because if they don't want to change, they're not going to.
Right, right.
So that's, yes, they're going to change. Or like your question was, I just can't change my mindset. It was getting them to understand, well, sure you can. Mm. Sure, you can change. You can change the way you think. You can change your attitude. Is it going to happen overnight? No. But it's awareness. Because how many times, because it's so easy to get into this negative loop, mm-hmm. right? And we start catastrophizing everything that's happening. But if we can stop and we can unpack it, then start to see that the way that I am interpreting this situation is maybe not accurate. Maybe this is not Mount Everest. Maybe this is a molehill. Mm-hmm. Maybe I've been strong in the past and I've shown courage. I can do that again. So those are the kind of thoughts that I would share with people.
Yeah.
And finally, I would say this. Don't forget what you probably should remember, and remember what you probably should forget.
Could you say it again?
Don't forget what you probably should remember, and remember what you probably should forget. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is, so often people default to the negative, right? Like, let's say they're on the tennis court and they're in the middle of a match, and maybe they default to, yeah, this has happened before. Here mm-hmm. I go again. Gonna freeze up. Gonna get the cement elbow. Yeah, I'm going to hit this one right out. I know it. I just know I'm going to do it. And sure enough, that's what happens. So what are they doing? They're maybe reliving something that happened in their past, and they're completely overlooking other experiences from their past that could drive a different result. Mm. Does that make sense? In other words, you know, it's that, and there's a lot of reasons why people do that, but one reason is that you falsely think it's going to relieve me of responsibility, because, you know, hey, look, it's not my fault. It's my, you know, my past. I failed before. I know how to do that. I'll just do it again. But it's flipping that switch and saying, no. Let's look at this. Look at this from a little different perspective. What are three or four matches from your past that you can use as examples of your courage, your resiliency? And let's cement those right now in your memory. And let's use that as evidence to support your resiliency, your courage.
No, that's great. Roger, I know you got to run. I wrote down many themes. You've already touched upon a few of them. What we could do another time is, you know, defeat is optional, difficult versus impossible. I love how you talked about real versus imaginary. I wrote down, just going through your videotapes. And then I have your books. And again,
so I'd love to come back again. It'd be great.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the time.
I know so many of our students, from the 80s. And it is great to have to hear Brandon say that every summer for you know, all the years he's been running summer camps, that he shared your story. And hopefully, I mean, so many people, I know you've been on the TV shows that are not even on now, like Real People or, you know, I mean, Larry King Live. And there's so many people who know your story, but I think everybody in tennis should know your story because it's
so remarkable. Much.
You mentioned Mary Carrillo. She was very emotional interviewing you and said she had never heard your story, but afterwards she said that Roger Crawford is my new favorite player. I thought that was great.
Yeah, she's terrific. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'd love to come back, and let's do this again soon.
Yeah, I'll touch base. But again, Roger Crawford, amazing. Great to have you on.
Thanks so much, Roger.
Thanks, guys. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks
okay,
again.
Bye-bye. Right,
bye. Take care. Bye.
Yeah, listeners, we'll come back with so many things. One thing for me, he used the verb unpack several times.
Yeah.
And you just think of someone having that emotional suitcase. You know, they're putting the weight of the world on their shoulders, and it's like they're carrying a 70-pound bag. You know, soldiers will carry a 70-pound bag, but you're out there, you know, with a racket that only weighs so much, and you're with a little yellow ball between the white lines. The other thing, thought, you know, there was a book I read many, many years ago called Mind Vitamins, and we use that as an exercise, as you know, and just say, okay, give me a mind vitamin on thought. You know, thought's your most powerful tool. If you think you can, you can. If you think you can't. It's all how you think. Or for teenage boys, when you're thinking, you're stinking. You know, they just create their own interference and they get in their own way. But what are some takeaways for you on that?
I thought it was great how he talked about mindset. He mentioned the growth mindset versus fixed mindset, Carol Dweck's book. I would think it would be pretty hard to be in his audience and to be thinking that, listening to him talk, obviously watching you know, what he's been able to overcome and what he accomplished on the tennis court, and then what he's accomplished off the tennis court with his work through, you know, motivational speaking and motivational coaching and working with, you know, like you said, not just tennis people, but all types of business people looking to maximize their potential. I think obviously what he was saying is that you can't change someone who doesn't want to change. So it starts with someone. They have to want to change themselves, but then showing that person where they've failed in the past and then looking at how they can then find where they've been successful in the past and then kind of trying to lead them to that conclusion.
The football coach Lou Holtz, usually when people change, it's when it finally becomes important to them. And unfortunately, when it becomes important to them, many times it's too late. And we're just talking about the window of, it's never too late in life, but say these young junior tennis players want to play college tennis. It's like an hourglass and the sand is sipping through. I mean, they've got to really try to put it together by their junior year in high school. They don't have to be frantic when they're 12 years old. You know, they couldn't go to the net and miss a volley, miss an overhead. I mean, there's so many things. When he says molehill, I mean, people do make a mountain out of a molehill.
Yeah.
But I think he's such a natural. People skills are off the chart, but just it's a natural mental toughness coach. You know, one thing about his game is his serve. You pretty much have the motion they have in cricket where they roundhouse it. So, you know, he had to hit the serve to the middle, but he could really move and he could keep balls coming back and forth. So we were fortunate enough to get out on the court and back in the 80s, I mean, he could flat out move and he could hit the ball. He could play. So all these kids, and I get a little bit tired of kids saying, I want to play D1, D1, D1. Right. It's confusing. There's some D3 teams that can beat D1 teams. But that thing, I just want to play.
Yeah.
I just want to play. It's like, I remember one time, I really wanted number 22, but the coach was handing out hockey jerseys and I just had this background and said, Smith, what number do you want? It doesn't matter. And he liked my answer. I really wanted number 22. But it's playing from the heart. So you just think about, you know, the number doesn't matter on your jersey. And, you know, the kids get hung up on the craziest little things, you know.
Sure.
But it's just happy. Hey, I'm just happy to get a jersey. What else, Brandon?
No, I'd encourage everyone, you know, after they've listened to this podcast or if they've watched it, staring at our ugly mugs, to check out his content on YouTube, whether it's to the tennis channel or just Google his name. And then also research his books. And I think everyone needs a dose of perspective, a dose of motivation. And I think he's a great source of that for many, many people.
Our network of coaches, I would make an assignment. Kids, at the end of the day, how much screen time they have. You know, if I watched one, I watched 25 the other day of the tennis channel clips that are on. There's so many short clips on YouTube. Trip, stumble, and fumble. The quote from Sports Illustrated, one of the most accomplished physically challenged athletes in the history of sport. I remember introducing Roger. It was one of the first times I was on a stage, all these TV cameras would look up, and you know, you can't see the audience. It's just all these lights. And I remember I had these 3x5 cards. It was a quote from Ronald Reagan. One thing that we could have asked him about is that he carried the Olympic torch. Mm-hmm. I think it was when the Olympics were in L.A. in 84. I wanted to ask. But, you know, it's interesting. You know, you listen to someone that you've known for a long time and followed. But I didn't realize that when he was a kid, there was no Paralympics. I remember a gentleman by the name of Mark Hamill. For years and years, it was a 3-year period. Slow down and get it right, where the place we were teaching was not wheelchair friendly. Mm-hmm. And he used to come across his field and he became top 10 in the U.S. And when we would have a ball pickup, back in those days, you would know, now we say 3-3. There was a period we said 2-2, but way back when it was 1-1. And
getting soft, Steve.
You just run to pick the balls up. I tease people now, well, kids can't, especially the younger kids, they can't pick up 4 balls in each hand, so pretty soon we'll be picking the balls up for them. But when the wheelchair player is pumping the wheels to pick the balls up, hot, humid, this is in Tyler, Texas, no one complained. Mm-hmm. There's no one complained. That I think his parents, pity city, pity party, that, you know, my mother, that was, I remember having Chuck Creasy online, said, hey, you could write a book just, and my mother said, but my mother had a problem with people feeling sorry for themselves, mm-hmm. you know, like snap out of it. Mm-hmm. And I do think that's one thing in tennis, that a lot of times kids get too much attention now. The families are smaller.
Right.
And how the helicopter parent comes in to the rescue and, you know, I think it's just straight across the board in this country where kids are understandably, and I've said this before on this podcast, understandably they are underprepared because they're overprotected. Mm. You know, I grew up where my parents didn't have a key to the house and they never looked for the keys to the car because the keys were in the car and you could go anywhere you wanted in this little town. So you became very independent. You could be creative and you weren't always with your mom or dad.
Right.
So the times have changed. I think the expression, a kid is still a kid, but the times have changed. He's in the Hall of Fame with the Intercollegiate, the ITA, Intercollegiate mm-hmm. Tennis Association. But I think Tennis Magazine nailed it years ago, Mr. Motivation. Just get a visual on it. Definitely, you know, look at the videos and go to his website, read his books, but get a visual on basically half a foot, half a leg, one finger on one hand, two on the other, mm-hmm. And taping the hand to his racket, mm. and he could flat out play. I think also, too, is, you know, he came out, he was a little fortunate enough to play with a T2000, and there's a story where, you know, he went to the pro shop and he picked the racket up and the racket, he got his one finger stuck mm-hmm. in the throat of the racket. There was a wall in the pro shop where he bought the racket so he could, or the department store. And, but also too, back in the day, kids learned to rally. And, now I think kids are lessened out. They're programmed out. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't say, hey, let's get on a court. Let's go half hour cross court. Forehand to forehand, or I mean, if you're with the lefty, it's different. Left, righty, lefty. But if you let's go cross court, backhand to backhand, let's go out and hit balls. Mm-hmm. And I think the people who are following our podcast as we put all these things together, Dr. Lehr, you know, how do you determine someone's going to be a great player? It's just that feel, the sound, that ball coming off their strings. It's like a drug to them. You know, Creasy said that, you know, once you can get so you can rally, you finally, you know, he wants people to still hit with a wooden racket and get the racket in the sweet spot. But hopefully, listening to Roger, we'll get him on again. All these pearls of wisdom, you know, these little nuggets that go in everybody's tennis treasure chest.
Sure. It's great.
Flanagan, Flanagan, Flanagan.
Number 86. Great one.
Number 86. Roger Crawford. No, there's Roger Federer and Roger Crawford. Both stories are totally, totally amazing. All I can think about was his adversity quotient. Mm. First time I ever heard that, get their name right, it wasn't Bill McClure, it was Bill McGowan. Jiwan Maharaj, like, got that name down. But yeah, I was at a tennis teaching workshop. Actually, Carlos Goffey mentioned that, and it rained. But he told a story about Dick Stockton and Brian Godfrey. They were roommates, and as freshmen, they practiced four times a day. The last practice of the day was playing a set. The first practice was hitting serves, but they found a way to play three more times in addition to the team practice. And like this yellow pad of paper I have on the table, they just taped it to their door in their dorm, and they played a set a day. And, you know, who won? It just went back and forth, but they both ended up in the NCAA final, I believe, playing each other. I have to confirm that, but my memory. But they both ended up being top 10 in the world. So during a rainy day, I had these tennis tech students and asked the former player from Trinity, McGowan, to tell the story. And he said, these guys had the adversity quotient. You know, how much can you take? And, we get kids complaining that we have a sunrise practice or that we're running on the track. And I'm always saying, well, you know, think about somebody, you know, they're in the wheelchair and they can't run on the track. But never, ever feel sorry for yourself. And that's really not adversity quotient. You know, and you can think about, okay, what did someone like Roger Crawford do? It's okay to mix up these two Rogers. But with what did they do to get to where they are? But I do think that we all need inspiration. Mm. And he's got to be one of the best examples, most inspiring people in the game of tennis.
Mm. Absolutely.
But listeners, thanks. I hope you got something out of this. I don't think there's any way you couldn't have. This one was a home run.
Absolutely. Thanks,
everyone. All right, Flanagan. Everybody, listeners, thank you. Adios.